Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 16.5 million football fans tune in most Sundays for those stunning long passes, wild touchdown dances, and the big hits. Those awe-inspiring, jaw-dropping hits grab attention for players on the field, but they can cause serious problems when the game is over. Repeated head trauma can trigger a degenerative brain disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. The issue gained renewed interest with the autopsy of the brain of former New England Patriot tight end Aaron Hernandez. He killed himself at the age of 27 while serving a life sentence for a murder conviction. Today we're talking about CTE and new developments in CTE research. Patrick Ruby recently wrote about a new technique for diagnosing the disease for The Atlantic. He joins us by phone. Well, welcome, Patrick Ruby.
Good to be here.
Patrick, could you start us out with a primer on what is CTE?
Sure. So CTE is a neurodegenerative disease, which means, you know, it gets worse over time. It's something that we've known about for a long time in boxers. And in other people that have suffered head trauma, repetitive head trauma. Back in the mid-2000s, it was first diagnosed in the autopsy brain of former Pittsburgh Steelers Hall of Fame center Mike Webster, which sort of kicked off the current and ongoing brain trauma crisis in football. You know, since then, we've been able to autopsy quite a few brains of deceased football players. This is high school, college, and former NFL players. And they found CTE in quite a few of them. Almost all the NFL brains they've looked at, they found it. A good number of college brains and some high school brains. Now, on those studies, we also know that the people that are actually volunteering their brains for study, generally them or their families had a feeling something was wrong. So it's a little bit of a skewed sample. We really don't know how common it is. But we know that it's linked to repetitive trauma. We know it's bad. And from what we know right now, it seems that you know, the longer you play, the more hits you take, the more likely you are to develop this and also other problems with your brain.
There's new research. There's new experimental screenings being done for CTE now. What are those?
So, like I said, right now, it can only be diagnosed after death. Like, neuropathologists literally have to take the brain. They have to cut up into small pieces, treat it in certain chemicals, and look at it under a microscope. And what they're looking for is tangles of a misfolded protein called tau, which essentially builds up in areas of the brain. It causes neuronal death, and that causes all sorts of dysfunction. So you have mood and behavior disorders, problems with memory, impulsiveness, explosiveness, all these sort of clinical symptoms that we see in people that are later diagnosed with it. Obviously, if you can only diagnose something definitively after death, that makes it very hard to study and hard to figure out how to treat. The new thing they're looking at right now, and this is experimental, is basically a brain scan that can look for these clumps of tau in the brains of living people. And there was recently, it was published last year, a study where they looked at a 39-year-old former NFL player who had suffered something like 20 concussions in his career. But again, concussions is not the same thing as repetitive head trauma, but that's a good proxy for how many times this guy was hit in the head. He's suffering from some of the clinical symptoms you might associate with CTE, you know, impulsivity, explosiveness, trouble with memory. And when they were able to use this experimental brain scan technique, they saw clumps, what looks to be clumps of tau in the same areas of the brain that they see upon autopsy. It matched with what they would expect because there are other neurodegenerative diseases that also have misfolded tau in the brain.
Well, it sounds a lot like Alzheimer's.
Yeah. What's that?
It sounds a lot like Alzheimer's.
Yeah, it is similar, and that's the thing. So what makes this new technique so promising is that it's a way to differentiate CTE from other diseases because that's the first step in any kind of, you know, figuring out how common this is and then figuring out what's really going on with it and then figuring out what can we do to treat it. You have to be able to know this person has CTE, they don't have Alzheimer's, they don't have some of these other diseases, or else, you know, you have nowhere to start. So it's a very significant step.
CTE won't necessarily, and I know you're not a scientist or an expert in this per se, but CTE won't occur without the trauma.
As far as we know.
Okay.
We know two things. We know that not everyone who suffers repetitive brain trauma ends up with CTE. or some of these other neurodegenerative diseases. But we know in all the cases we've seen of it, that seems to be the thing that you have to have. So that's led to a lot of speculation that there are probably other factors. There are probably genetic factors that raise or lower your risk. There's probably behavioral factors, environmental factors. They're pretty certain at this point, like I said, exposure over time increases risk. It's a lot like smoking. Not everyone that smokes ends up with lung cancer, but we know that smoking is a great risk factor for it. And the more you smoke over a longer time, the more likely you are to get it. That seems to be a similar model at this point.
How has the NFL responded to these reports and past findings on CTE? You mentioned in your story how the league supported a $16 million study to research it, but then backed out. What happened there?
So there's a big study. The people that are most the experimental study I'm talking about is being done at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. But the other people that do the most work on CTE are Boston University, and they were applying to the NIH. For a grant that was going to be NFL money. The NFL was giving money to the NIH to then give to scientists. And they're basically doing at Boston, it's going to be the largest study of CTE that's ever been done. It's going to take place over 7 years. They're going to use these kinds of scans I've been talking about and all sorts of other ways of trying to look at blood, look at biomarkers, do clinical examinations. And they're basically going to try to come up with a definitive way to diagnose this in living people. $60 million study, like you said. And what happened is the NFL tried to divert the money, tried to influence the NIH to give it to another study and not give it to the people at Boston University. Boston University are the people that sort of brought CTE to national attention.
Right.
The NFL is not, like, really friendly with them, let's put it that way, and probably vice versa. And I think, once that got out into the public, there was, Congress got involved. There was a lot of publicity for the NFL. And basically the NIH said, you know what, you said you were going to give us this money, no strings attached. This looks like strings. We're just going to fund this ourselves. Keep your money. And that's sort of what happened. The NFL has poured money into research, but generally that money goes to people who are either friendly with the NFL or it's going to things like making a safer helmet, which is really a kind of thing that a helmet can only do so much. It's not going to prevent your brain inside your skull rattling around and getting damaged from sort of the forces that happen. Helmets are great at skull fractures, but not so great at protecting the brain.
There are actually people who theorize, maybe it's more than a theory, that the better helmets are part of the problem.
Yeah, there's, you know what? There could be some truth to that. What a better helmet allows you to do, a helmet that more protects you against skull fracture does allow you to then use your head as a weapon, potentially. So you can lead on tackles with your head, things like that. But also, in general, it makes you more likely to hit harder, to be more reckless in your play. And look, football's a violent game. The point of the game is to put the guy in front of you on the ground before he does the same thing to you. It's always going to be violent. There's no way around that. The basic physics and biology means to do that, you have to get lower, you have to drop your shoulders, your head's connected to your shoulders. We're not Lego men. We can't take our heads off and then play football. Mm-hmm. So the head is always going to be at risk. And so, yeah, there are people that feel that way. I think if you talk to the experts that really are studying this right now, their suspicion is that's part of it. But their other suspicion is that football players just play so much more football now than they did back in the day of worse helmets. They play year-round. The seasons are longer. They're more intense. Everyone's bigger, faster, and stronger. And they start playing at much younger ages. It used to be you probably started in high school back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Now people start at age 5. We've seen Friday Night Tights. They start at age 5 with helmets and pads hitting each other.
Yeah, I was surprised that's even allowed. When I was reading and preparing for this, I didn't know that tackling was allowed before, like, junior high.
Right. No, it is. And that's a change. I mean, it was never banned or not banned, but it wasn't really that common. Back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, tackle football for kids really kind of came into vogue in the 70s and beyond. Actually, in the 1990s, the NFL and the Players Union put like $100 million into promoting tackle football for kids, specifically because they were worried that football wasn't cool anymore, that kids were turning to the NBA and turning to extreme sports and weren't interested in the NFL. And the idea was get a football in their hand, get a helmet on their head before they're like 6 or 7 years old, and you're going to create a fan for life. And now that might be something that backfires on the sport. There are a lot of people who are saying, we should stop this. We should not have tackle below age 14. There's no reason for it. Flag football is a good game. You can learn the skills. You can have fun. You can protect kids' brains. There's a lot of logic to that, but football is so ingrained in our culture that it's probably going to take a long time for that to sort of spread, and it'll probably happen organically, not necessarily with lawmakers or anyone imposing it from the top down.
You mentioned the player that they did the live CTE scan or live scan to looking for CTE on, and they found it. And but you don't name them. You mentioned why. Can you talk about the stigma associated with CTE?
Well, you know, I mean, two things to note on that is one is that they're not sure it's CTE.
Okay.
It just it looks like it.
Gotcha.
You know, they have to verify this test. I mean, so what they're really seeing is, you know, they put basically a radioactive tracer into your blood. That tracer, that specific tracer, attaches to the tau, right, that we talked about, the bad tau.
Mm-hmm.
And then they look for that on the scan, and they're seeing it concentrated in the same areas they would see in the brain on autopsy. So they suspect, yeah, between this and this player's clinical symptoms, we can tentatively say this is CTE, but a lot of work is going to need to be done in terms of testing other players, testing other athletes, and people that have suffered trauma, waiting for them, this sounds macabre, but waiting for them to pass away so they can look at their brains and try and confirm, does what we see on autopsy match what we saw on these scans? It's going to take time to be really confident in this, but it's a very good start. In terms of your question about stigma,
yeah,
absolutely. There's a lot of stigma around brain damage in our society, a tremendous amount. And that's really unfortunate because I do think that pushes athletes and non-athletes into trying to hide this, not seeking the help they need, not coming forward about it, and not talking about it, which is helpful to them, but also helpful to the rest of us in terms of understanding, helping them deal with it.
And another point to clarify that I can't remember if I brought it up earlier or not. You called concussions good markers for all of this, but that you don't have to have a concussion to suffer the trauma that can lead to CTE.
That's
it
right.
Could just be hits.
That's right. That's right. In fact, the people that research this feel it's much more, what seems to be much more risky is not one concussion, two concussions, a handful of concussions. It's the repetitive, smaller, non-concussive hits that happen over and over and over and over in football. And at every level of the game, you know, they've studied this now. You know, youth football players we were talking about, they're getting like 600, 800 hits in a season. High school players are getting like double that. College players are getting even more. NFL players are getting even more. One of the good things that is happening in football and needs to happen is it's a small step, but it's an important step, is you see in the NFL and you see starting to trickle down to college and high school, they're starting to limit the amount of tackling that's being done not in game. So that's whether that's practices, training camp, off season. They're trying to reduce that amount of exposure. It's very akin to cigarettes, you know. We can't get you to stop smoking totally. Maybe we can get you to not smoke two packs a day, but only smoke two packs over the course of 4 months. Again, it's not going to eliminate the risk, but the feeling is it will help reduce it. So that's right now one of the steps you can take today to try to make the sport safer.
And I you know, I mentioned earlier how many people are tuning in on a Sunday, 16.5 million people are on most Sundays to watch pro football games. There's a decline, though, in interest in the sport at the younger levels, right? I mean, they're starting younger and younger, but there is a decline.
Right. There is. We've seen a drop-off, and it does correspond to when this became sort of a national issue. So if you look at sort of the start of this decade to now, there's been, depending on what stats you look at, it's like a 20 to 30% drop in youth football participation. There's been a dip also in high school football participation over that time. And there's 1 or 2 years where it went up a little bit, but the overall trend line is down. And, you know, there's no way to know for sure that's all connected to brain trauma because we've also seen dips in youth sports participation across the board. So it could be part of that trend too. But it's likely that this is a concern. It's likely this is one of the things fueling that. I mean, football is beloved, but parents also really love their children and want them to be healthy. And, you know, of anything you need in life to have a good life, you need your brain working. You know, it's one thing to blow out your knee or hurt your ankle or have sort of a gimpy shoulder for the rest of your life, but you really enjoyed high school football and it was worth it to you. It's another thing to have brain trauma that affects your daily existence and affects who literally you are for the rest of your life. That's not a trade a lot of people will make if they really understand the risk and really, you know, want to avoid it.
Patrick Ruby, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick Ruby is a writer for The Atlantic. We'll have a link to his article about CTE and new technology in studying it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More conversation coming up about head trauma, football, and CTE. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The ranks of high school football players has shrunk by 23% since 2009. That's according to the Ohio High School Athletic Association. The association spokesman, Tim Streed, explained the decline in a September interview with Steve Brown of 89.7 NPR News.
I think families are now making the decision when, if at all, to let their sons or in some cases daughters play tackle football. And concerns are certainly there about concussions and the lasting effects of that. We certainly still hope kids play football. We can talk about that. I think that football's safer now than it's ever been.
That's the question. We're talking about the favored fall sport of football and growing awareness among players and their parents of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. It's a degenerative brain disease related to concussions and head trauma in general and contact sports, especially football. Joining us by phone is concussion expert and director of research and development at the Samford Sports Science Institute in South Dakota, Dr. Thane Muntz. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ann, for having me.
Also by phone, pediatric rehabilitation physician at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. Carl Klamar. Dr. Klamar specializes in brain injuries and concussions. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Ann.
Dr. Klamar, we're focused on football, but any contact sports runs the risk, right?
Absolutely. We know that there are high incidences in other contact sports such as hockey and rugby. But significant incidents in sports not considered to be contact sports, such as basketball and soccer.
Mm-hmm. They're not because, and then another thing that was brought up earlier in the program, and I wanted to talk with both of you about, is this issue of concussions are considered the ultimate marker, but you can have a lot of trauma without actually being suffering from a concussion, and that trauma can contribute to CTE. Right, Dr. Muntz?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, concussion gets most of the headlines, but there's a growing amount of appreciation for what's known as repetitive subconcussive head impacts. So these are the impacts that football players take on a play-by-play basis. And we're beginning to learn more about some of the effects those hits can have on short-term neurologic function. And there's also great concern that those are really the types of impacts that may contribute to the long-term disease like CTE.
I was surprised, Dr. Klamar, that children, young children, can play tackle football. I didn't know it was even allowed.
So it's very much varies community to community, but there are children starting as young as 5 years old with tackle football, although in some communities the age for contact is limited to third grade or even older.
Does it matter if you're getting this kind of trauma at a young age?
So we previously had thought that because children with lower mass, because they weighed less, didn't have the ability to generate the kind of hits that could be responsible for concussions. But we now know through some research that, in fact, if we put a force transducer in the helmet of children at that young age, we can measure both the subconcussive kind of blows, but even the more significant blows that are responsible for concussions in that age group.
And is it common?
It is less common, I think, than in the high school aged and college aged players. The problem is that we don't have good data on youth football. The NCAA gives us the best data because they require concussion reporting. In recent years, we've gotten better data at the high school level, but when we get to the middle school level and below, there are too many entities involved, and there isn't consistency in reporting.
Dr. Muntz, how has the study of brain trauma and sports evolved over the years? How has it changed?
Yeah, there have been a lot of advancements made. Initially, a lot of work went into just really trying to understand what concussions were and what some of the signs and symptoms of a concussion are and how we can properly diagnose that. And now we're learning more about proper ways to manage and treat those types of injuries. Some of the newer changes have been in the development of the measurements of on-the-field impacts, as was discussed, at football players of all ages, trying to really understand the risk of subconcussive injury and how that may relate to both short-term and long-term changes. And then certainly all the work with late-life effects, such as CTE and other potential degenerative brain diseases. So we're really just scratching the surface, unfortunately. We still have more questions than we have answers. We've come a long way, particularly in regard to concussion recognition and management. But there's a lot of other brain injuries that are out there that we really need to understand better.
Is there any suspicion, and of course, obviously, you're both experts, you can chime in. Is there any suspicion that a lot of dementia cases are related to trauma, not just that there's trauma involved in it? Dr. Clamart?
I think that we're still kind of in the infancy of trying to figure that out. And it takes really very large numbers to get to something that can give you that kind of answer. Certainly there are more correlations that we are seeing. There was an article published in Translational Psychiatry just last month, looking at age of exposure to football and its contribution to neuropsychiatric and cognitive decline. And what they really found was that age of exposure, of first exposure, was more important than either total years or the eventual level, whether it's college or NFL, that people progress to.
And age of exposure meaning the younger you're exposed, the more damage, or the older you're exposed, the more damage?
The younger you're exposed, the more symptoms that we're seeing in adulthood.
Dr. Muntz?
I've seen some of those reports as well, and as the other guests mentioned, a lot of this work is very early on, and there's a number of confounding factors that need to be accounted for. I think it's very difficult to look at one or two particular studies that may have a group of athletes that you would group into their age of exposure being, say, before age 12 and after age 12, not having control groups, not accounting for other types of sports, other types of high-impact activities, and then relating those directly toward what happens 20, 30, 40 years down the road. I think that research is very valuable, but I think that there's been some concerns with some of those studies that have come out about their lack of control and potential selection bias. So I think we need to be somewhat cautious about making too firm of conclusions based on the research that's out there. It's certainly concerning and something that we need to study further.
Dr. Clamart, I'm curious about your work at Nationwide Children's Hospital and how well you think children are prepared to report on symptoms.
So as was mentioned in terms of the CTE research, similarly in concussion, we do not have a brain scan or a blood test that can tell us when someone's had a concussion, or, and more importantly, when the concussion has resolved. So it is symptom report that we rely on. We have done some research here looking at the validity of reporting for children, and we do see children as low as young as 5 years old in our clinics. And as you can imagine, a five-year-old's ability to report their symptoms is quite limited. So we rely primarily on parent report of what the child's symptoms are and how it's different from before their injury. We know that there's recall bias in that parents, when you ask them in the emergency room versus 4 weeks after the injury, that their responses are very different. So it's a very difficult thing to assess what symptoms are occurring, what symptoms are new, and whether we've actually gotten to a point of resolution of symptoms.
Hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about sports-related brain trauma. My guest, you just heard from Dr. Carl Klamar. He's founder and co-director of the Pediatric Concussion Program at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Also with us by phone, Dr. Thane Muntz. He's a concussion researcher at the Samford Sports Science Institute in South Dakota. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. 614-292-8513 is the number, though, if you want to call. What are the treatments for CTE usually isn't diagnosed until after death, Dr. Muntz, but for suspected CTE, what do you do? How do you treat it?
I'll start my comment just by saying that I'm not a physician, so I'm a research scientist, and you know what I'm about to say should not be taken as any type of medical advice or opinion. But
okay.
As you do mention, this is a disease that we don't have a treatment or a cure for. There are symptoms, so you know some people who have been diagnosed with CTE earlier in life showed signs of depression or irritability or other, you know, outward symptoms that could be treated to some extent, some of those symptoms. But treating the underlying disease is really something similar to Alzheimer's disease that, you know, we need to make great progress to get to that point that we can actually stop the disease in its tracks and prevent further progress. So that's what makes it difficult, even as, you know, we move forward toward being able to potentially diagnose the disease in the living, it raises a big question about, well, what do we do next? Do we have a treatment? And we don't at the current time. So what type of information, what type of advice, what type of medical care is able to be provided to those individuals if they learn that they have this disease while they're living?
And Dr. Klamar, when you have a patient who's 5 years old and they're coming to you with a concussion, is part of your recommendation to the parent that they shouldn't play football anymore?
So it's rare that we make the recommendation at that young of an age after a single injury. The pattern that we look for is multiple injuries, injuries that are occurring with less force to the blow, or injuries that are resulting in symptoms that are progressively worse or progressively long-lasting. Those would be the triggers that we would want to start talking about avoiding activities with the potential for contact or collision.
Amy in Pickerington, you're on the air. Hi, Amy.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share that my father suffered a series of successive concussions playing high school football back in the 70s, and he has started to show some symptoms of CTE. And I'm kind of curious, as his family member, first of all, how can I be aware of his condition, symptoms, progression? And also, second, how does someone like him, who doesn't have the financial resources of an NFL football player, or the benefit of an accurate diagnosis, since it's not diagnosable until autopsy, how does someone in that state, I guess, go about seeking more care, more help, more ways to live with this.
Dr. Muntz, are there studies? Is there research going on that where they're looking for people like her father?
There's starting to be more and more studies around the country of people enrolling not only former NFL players but also collegiate players and even high school players to really be able to understand the prevalence. That's one thing that we don't know is how prevalent this disease is. So there may be some opportunities for her father to be enrolled in a study where there may be some testing and potential diagnostic capabilities provided. The larger issue that she speaks of is very challenging and very difficult just because of the points I made earlier that we don't have good treatments for this condition right now, and we can't confirm its diagnosis in the living. So I certainly feel for the situation and the challenge that she presents.
Amy, thanks a lot for your call. Mac in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mac.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm pretty interested in this subject because I played junior high and high school football myself up through my junior year, and then I didn't play my senior year. I eventually became a nurse and an injury epidemiologist. I'm retired now, but, I thought about it, myself over the years, my own experiences. I've seen stars a few times. I was knocked out once, fainted a few times from heat. So, I think I've got some risk there. I'm 61, and, I really think that we're heading towards a point where people have to start thinking of this in moral terms, and how can you let your kids play a game that could end up giving you Parkinson's or dementia, at an early age, fairly early age, depression, suicide, everything that seems to come out of some of the results of these chronic injuries. I don't know what the guests think about that, but I think maybe the legal challenges are going to end up kind of ending football as we know it. I think it's a matter of time.
Mac, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Dr. Clamart, is there a moral component here?
The one thing I want to emphasize is what we said before, that we're still not even sure about incidents, other risk factors that contribute. So it's very difficult to say that we need to get rid of football or any other sport at this time. I can tell you that I let my own children play football when they were young. They're now 19 and 21, so the knowledge was not where it is right now. I'm glad that I personally don't have to make that decision at this time.
Dr. Muntz?
A lot of people are bringing up the moral and ethical issues, and I would echo what Dr. Clamar said, that we're still so early on in the research, and it's easy to jump to conclusions based on some of the headlines and some of the findings we've seen. But I'd like to point out that a lot of what we know about the long-term effects of football and how that's been linked to CTE and compounding factors aside, when we talk about the question of youth football, although we do know that impacts that youth football players experience can be similar in force to what high school, collegiate, and professional players experience, they happen at a far lower rate. So the overall exposure that a youth football player at age 12 experiences, for example, is going to be quite a bit less than a high school player and certainly less than a collegiate or a professional player. So when we look at the examples of NFL players who have played oftentimes 4 years in high school, 4 years of college, and 3 to 5, maybe even 10 years in the NFL, the amount of exposure they've had to that risk is far greater than what the typical youth player would experience. We need to realize that 98% of football players never play beyond high school. So they're only getting exposure up to that high school level. That's not to say that none of those players will ever develop long-term degenerative disease, but the risk should be substantially less because the amount of exposure they've experienced is going to be reduced. And we need to learn more about that, especially at that younger age.
We will continue our conversation about head trauma and football and long-term degenerative brain disease when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This is a college football town. Nothing is bigger than the Buckeyes, but they're only human. And standout plays often end with big hits that can lead to concussions, one of the most serious concerns for football players. They routinely gamble that they won't be hit with a degenerative brain disease associated with not just concussions, but repeated head trauma that may not be diagnosed as a concussion. Symptoms include memory loss, impulse control issues, and depression. This summer, the Journal of the American Medical Association studied the brains of deceased football players from all levels of the game. Of the 53 collegiate football players examined, 48 revealed signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, and that's what we're talking about. Still with us by phone, Dr. Carl Klamar from the Concussion Clinic at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Dr. Klamar, thanks again for joining us.
Certainly, Ann.
And Dr. Thane Muntz from Sanford Sports Science Institute in South Dakota. Thanks again for joining us as well, Dr. Muntz.
You bet. My pleasure.
I wanted to start with some audio from an interview Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers did in 2016 on HBO. He talked about the mindset of players facing injuries.
When you're competitive, the last thing you want to do is come out of a game, regardless of what kind of injury. Whether it's an ankle, a knee, a rib, or a head injury. You know that the head injuries are obviously more dangerous, but it's that mindset is wanting to play through those kind of things. And until that mindset changes, there's going to be guys like Calvin who come out and say, I played through a lot of concussions.
Dr. Klamar, how much of dealing with head injuries is coping with that mindset?
Oh, so a lot of it is. And we see it in my practice. It's not only the kids who want to continue, but sometimes it is their parents who really want them to continue. And it can be very difficult to convince someone that a child needs to sit out for their health. It's a warrior sport. It's a warrior mentality. And it wasn't that long ago that the message on the sideline was definitely, rub some dirt in it and get back in there, mm-hmm. I think we're seeing things change, but it is not an overnight change. There's been a lot of education at the youth level on up through college and certainly in the NFL in educating coaches and medical staff of the dangers and the need to be really aware of concussions and make sure that if there's a suspicion that player is removed from the game.
Lisa in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I wanted to share with you, I'm a retired teacher, but I had a teaching fifth grade. I had a fourth grade student in our building who was in the youth hockey league, and he was the goalie, got hit in the head in fourth grade. And by fifth grade, his records, of course, came up to me, and there was a short-term memory loss. And the worry for me was, how does this continue on to his life? And are people also looking as far as research into hockey? Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Lisa. Hockey, any contact sport is an issue, right, Dr. Muntz?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And actually, there was just a summit hosted last week by the Mayo Clinic, which specifically addressed brain injury in hockey, and that is as big an issue in that sport as it is in football, and there's a lot of concern. One of the things they have in that sport is fighting that you don't see as often in football that contributes to a lot of the brain trauma that athletes experience in that particular sport. And internationally, people are looking at rugby and soccer as other sports where brain trauma occurs at a relatively high rate.
You know, in hockey, checking is, in youth hockey, to my knowledge, checking is not allowed until high school, though. Unlike in football, which again, I was surprised to hear, tackle football starts as young as five.
Right. There have been some advances made in the sport of hockey to limit the amount of contact, the checking that goes on at the younger levels. And you are correct that tackle football does exist at very young ages. In my community, it starts at second grade, and in other communities, it starts a little bit younger and others a little bit older. But you know, there certainly is full contact practice in football, and that's something that's being hotly debated as to what the appropriate age to introduce tackling to football is, and we don't have good data like so many other things we've talked about today.
Mm-hmm.
I can say that flag football has really become more popular nationwide and is being used more and more as an entry into the sport of football, and is being used that at higher levels at for older athletes as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that changes over the next several years.
You know, they limit in baseball, in youth baseball, how often a pitcher can be at the mound. And I guess it's more about saving their arm for future games than it is about saving them from injury and future trauma to their body.
Correct. And there is a similar analogy for football in particular, but it certainly would apply to any of these other contact sports, and that's to implement a hit count, so similar to the pitch count that you're alluding to.
Uh-huh.
And in order to do that, you would need impact sensors in helmets or headgear or worn on the head to be able to count the number of impacts and the severity of impacts. And that technology does exist. However, it's not quite as good as we would like it to be right now for consumer use. And we also don't know what certain thresholds of impacts are that relate to cognitive decline, whether that's short-term or long-term brain damage. So while we have the capability of collecting data on head impact exposure or hit counts, we have very limited information to give back to parents or players to say, this number of hits is too many, or you've accumulated too many hits that's going to lead to a long-term injury. We don't have that data available to us right now, but I think we're headed in that direction.
I read an article by Julie DeCaro of the Washington Post. She wrote from her own personal experience as a parent of two travel football players, youth travel football players, and she talked about the new anti-concussion helmet. For $299, she said parents could protect their children from hard hits to the head. And I was wondering, Dr. Clamart, what you think about the new and improved equipment that comes out. And in fact, that helmet's been debunked, I guess, subsequently. But what about the equipment? Does it help? Is it better? Is it worth it?
Yeah. So as was mentioned previously, helmets are good at limiting skull fractures. The previous standards for helmets in football as well as in other sports were based on their ability to limit skull fractures, not to limit injury to the brain. When you're talking about a hit that is equivalent to running into a brick wall at 40 miles an hour, I don't think that there is any helmet that you can conceive of that is going to protect the brain from an injury in that situation. There has been some effort spearheaded by Virginia Tech University to come up with a rating system to rate helmets for their ability to protect against concussion. So they have standards for football helmets and hockey helmets, and it's their intention to come out with standards for lacrosse helmets as well. But again, there's some debate as to whether that's actually an accurate measure of what's going on in the brain. I think that anyone who claims that they can prevent a concussion with the helmet or even reduce the likelihood of concussion, the data is just not there to back up those claims.
Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I do have a question. My son played rugby at the college level and probably got a couple hits that were pretty good to his head. Around that same time, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And I wanted to know if your guest has any comments on that, whether there's been connection with head injury and bipolar disorder. He was a college-age boy, so it's also time when bipolar disorder might be starting to show up.
Anyways, yeah. Mary, thanks a lot for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Muntz, does that kind of correlation pop up in your research?
You know, we haven't seen that directly in our research, but I will say that that's a limited sample size with the athletes that we've worked with, and mm-hmm. they've typically been of a younger age, of a middle school age, although we do also include some high school and collegiate athletes in our data set. I will say that there are a number of neurologic, psychologic conditions that do pop up and do occur among some of our participants, being able to make a causation or association mm-hmm. between their concussion that they may have had and the existence of another condition is always difficult when you're working with small numbers. I don't know that it's beyond the realm of possibility. The brain is very complex, and the way in which where the damage occurs and how it could affect other neural pathways is certainly a possibility. But again, like many of the things we've talked about today, you have to exercise some caution before right. making those links.
Dr. Klamar?
So as the caller alluded to, the college age is when bipolar depression often does manifest itself first. So it may not be related to the injuries at all. But I agree very much with Dr. Muntz that it's such a complicated mm-hmm. question that it's really, really difficult to answer.
Mary, thanks a lot for your call again. Do you, either of you, envision, we're just about out of time, but I'm wondering, do either of you envision a time when, through research, eventually is the goal, if it is genetic, if you can start to screen people and say, you're genetically predisposed for this or that? I mean, is that what you're shooting for?
I think that would be one of the goals of research. Certainly, we have an eye on that, as others do, of looking at this genetic susceptibility issue. However, that's going to be very complex. It's not likely. In fact, it's nearly impossible that one or two genes are going to be responsible for describing someone's susceptibility to concussion or CTE. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a very diverse set of genetic indicators that may all come together along with the environmental factors. You always have to look at the environment and the biology working together. So it's a very difficult challenge. Obviously that's something that medical researchers would like to put their fingers on and be able to have that tool available to them, but it's going to be a big undertaking.
Well, Dr. Thane Muntz, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Thane Muntz is a concussion researcher at the Samford Sports Science Institute in South Dakota. And also Dr. Carl Klamar, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ann.
Dr. Carl Klamar is founder and co-director of the Pediatric Concussion Program at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Thanks to Courtney Gilbert for producing this show. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lynette, AllSides interns Kyle McKinnon, Courtney Gilbert, Dan Posniak, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Thanks again for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.